I'm really excited about this topic, and I think you will be too. The title is, Noah's Ark Has Evidently Been Found. Now, of course, the word evidently is important. There is a lot of evidence. However, we can't say absolutely 100% that it has been found. But there is by far more evidence now than there ever has been in the past. This was officially announced in a press conference on April 27th. Right away, it began to hit the headlines and newspaper articles around the world and on the internet and so forth. However, I did not hear about this until a few days ago on May 15th. And I don't know, even though it has been news all around the world, yet I can't understand why there has not been even a lot more news, why it hasn't dominated the news a lot more than it has. How many of you heard already in the past week or so, or let's say in the past month, how many of you have heard of a find in the news? Raise your hand. Okay, you see, well, there's about a dozen of you that heard. Well, good for you. And so I didn't hear about it until Mario Siegley, who I think you know who he is. He's a pastor in Southern California there, and one of his special interests has been the search for Noah's Ark for like 30 years. And he's always met each claim with a lot of skepticism. But whereas the people that were on the expedition itself, they are saying they feel 99.9% sure it is Noah's Ark. And Mario Siegley, even as careful as he is, he says he feels it is 95% sure. And so this is monumental. This is huge. I can understand why, with all the claims in the past, which have been disappointing because either there's some of the claims were hoaxes and some claims just never offered any real evidence, that people think, oh yeah, here we go again, woof, woof, just another claim is going to, found to be not true or not substantiated, not corroborated and not proven. But however, and then of course, many people don't want this news. They are going to try to deny it with everything they can possibly think of to say because they don't want to believe it. They don't want to believe in the Bible. They don't want to believe in even in God in many cases. And so there's going to be a lot of opposition to this news. But as more and more evidence comes forth, and I pray that it will, because there's many things that could happen in the world that could prevent further photography and verification of this. There have been hundreds of people who have, over the years, have tried to climb Mount Ararat and to look for Noah's Ark. In fact, and it's been documented in many, many books. One of the ones that I happened to find years ago in a used bookstore is called The Ark of Ararat. You can see it's a pretty thick book by Tim LaHaye and John Morris. Tim LaHaye is a famous writer, as you know, and John Morris is somebody who had a special interest and went on some expeditions up Mount Ararat himself. And yet it's amazing how many things have interfered with people either getting up Mount Ararat or being able to come back with substantial proof, or else if they did come back with a lot of proof, the proof disappeared or somebody died. And it seems clear to me that God has been holding off until it was His time. God determined the timing of this. God did not want it to be that clear earlier than this. But for some reason, God has chosen this time for it to be made clear and substantiated. In fact, this expedition has formed primarily of Christians, Chinese Christians from Hong Kong, and some Turkish people. Now, of course, Mount Ararat is in Turkey, and they're the ones that have the control of it, and they have to get permission before anybody can even try to climb Mount Ararat or even go in that area. It's been a very sensitive part of the world. Mount Ararat sits right where Turkey and Armenia and Iran come together. And until 1991, Armenia was part of the Soviet Union and was completely under the domination of the Soviets. And so it was a very hot spot politically and militarily. And many, many requests have been denied over the years for various reasons. In fact, until recently, until this news came out, I felt skeptical that it would ever be found. Because I thought, well, you know, the Bible tells us that God hid Moses' body. And if the ark was found, maybe people would tend to worship the ark. And maybe God just doesn't want it to ever be found. And maybe it has rotted away and no longer exists. And then it also occurred to me that maybe God doesn't want people to have that much absolute proof of the veracity of the Bible, so that it's easier for people to disbelieve and so that God can have more mercy on them and so forth. But we know that God wanted a more powerful witness in the very end time. And now it seems to me that this is going to be part of the witness, so that human beings here in the end time have less excuse for their disbelief and their denial of the truth of the Bible. One reason I thought that maybe they would never be allowed to find it is that Turkey is like 99% Muslim. And I was thinking, well, the Muslims, they really wouldn't want Christianity to be proven and the Bible to be proven, because that would make it look like, well, they don't have the best religion, that the Quran is not as true as the Bible. But, you know, maybe God had this put into the Quran. The Quran mentions the flood and the ark. And so I thought, oh, it's a good thing, I guess. Because the way the Muslims are going to look at this, well, this helps to substantiate the truth of the Quran as well as our Bible. So Mario Sigli is really excited about this, and I'll tell you a little bit about Arnold Mendez. He's someone who was ordained about a year and a half ago, the longtime deacon, and then now he's an elder. He's in the Corpus Christi, Texas church, and understanding and studying and explaining Noah's Ark has been a special project of his for many, many years. In fact, he has traveled around the United States to various congregations putting on seminars about Noah's Ark. And some of you have probably either seen it in person or seen it on his website. And so what he does when he goes around giving seminars is to prove that the Ark was plenty big to house all the animals that would need to be put onto the ark, and showing the logic of the dimensions and how seaworthy it is and how it would likely be built. And he's even built a model of the ark that shows how practical it would have been and how it would have worked and how they would have stored the grain. And so there are a lot of very interesting things that he presents in his seminar. So I called Mario Sigli to talk to him this week and exchange some emails, and I also called Arnold Mendez and talked to him for a while, and he's all excited about this as well. And I wanted to sort of surprise you today about this subject, but when I get home this evening, I plan to email all of you that have email some links. First of all, the link that is put up by this expedition that did this research lately. They have their own website with lots of information. You certainly want to go up to the right-hand corner where it has ENG for English, because otherwise it's all going to be in Chinese. But I think it's rather remarkable. As many Americans have wanted to go up there and be the first to bring back proof of the Ark, it turns out to be an expedition composed of Chinese and Turkish people. And these people are very excited about this. This, undoubtedly, if this is true, this is the greatest archaeological discovery ever. It not only is monumental in showing such a giant, giant miracle, because in some ways, when you just think of, well, what, looking at it kind of in a physical sense, what is the greatest miracle ever? Well, the parting of the Red Sea would be obvious, great, but this is something to have the waters cover the entire earth over everything, over the tops of the mountains and everything. It's such a monumental event. And so people, even people who sort of believed in the Bible, many times had a hard time believing that that was literally true. And of course, if the flood occurred, then that knocks in the head many people's viewpoints about geology, paleontology, the history of the earth, so many sciences are affected, as well as it is just a huge blow to the theory of evolution and a huge blow to their theories about the history of the earth and what formed our erosion and the effects of, because many people still want to believe that most of the effects of the earth have been just gradual, what they call uniformitarianism, where it's just been a gradual erosion and gradual changes, and nothing suddenly happened. And yet there's been lots of evidence from the findings geologically and paleontological finds to indicate that there have been major, sudden, dramatic things happen on the earth. And this is certainly one of the biggest. This is so important that as a freshman in Ambassador College, one of our Bible classes devoted an entire semester mostly to studying that Genesis 6 through 9. The story of the flood and the ark, and doing a lot of what Martel Mendez has been doing, and that is proving that the ark was big enough to hold all the animals, and that all of this makes sense, and all of this affects all these different sciences and everything. And we had a textbook called the Genesis Flood, and that was the textbook, and of course it's still a popular book. Now, it's not that we who are called and already have the Holy Spirit and have faith, it's not that we need this to strengthen our faith, because we already were absolutely convinced. But think of most people who have not been absolutely convinced of the truth of this. This is huge witness to them and to the world. And I hope we can take maximum advantage of this in preaching the gospel. You know, maybe some of you would like to ask questions after this sermon, and so maybe we can have a Q&A. But I, you know, I don't want to disturb the rest of you that don't want to be involved in the Q&A. So maybe those that would like to be in on a Q&A about this subject, we could kind of get one corner of this room. And I won't need a microphone, but we'll try to do that. Let's see, I guess maybe just right over here in this area, this corner of the room. Give you a brief timeline here. In 2004, the Noah's Ark Ministries from Hong Kong first explored Mount Ararat, but they didn't find anything then. In 2006, a Turkish mountain climber discovered a wood structure, got a sample, and had it tested, and it turned out to be petrified wood. And 2007, combined expedition team uncovered a massive wood structure and took some photographs and videos. But see, we haven't heard anything about this until the spring of 2010. So they have been keeping this hush-hush, even though from 2006 on they thought they had found it. But they wanted more proof. They knew that if they didn't have a lot of evidence, a lot of photographs and things like that, that most people are not going to believe them. And so they kept this hush-hush with more and more expeditions. In 2008, they decided that this Hong Kong team and the Turkish team would officially collaborate. That they would, they signed a document that they would work together on this. And then they did more exploring of that structure. And the big breakthrough came in 2009 because there's been some meltback because Noah's Ark has been under ice and snow most of the time. But part of the reason that in some years people would claim to see part of it and other years they would go back and they say, oh, we can't see anything. It's because you have some meltbacks in some years, and then maybe the next year, the next winter, you have a lot more ice form and a lot more snow dumped on top, and it just totally obliterates any view at all, and they can't find it again. So in October of this past year, they had a big breakthrough, and they had a photography crew with them and did a lot of filming and found seven different compartments that they went into, explored the inside of those compartments, and these are huge, some of them were huge compartments, and with their photographers, but they didn't actually, for some reason, they waited until April of this year to officially announce all of this. Mount Ararat, the peak of it, is 16,946 feet. The Ark is located at 4,000 meters, which is 13,120. So the peak is 16,000, almost 17,000. And the Ark is at 13,120. So it's not near to the peak, but it's certainly above the permanent permafrost line. In other words, it's up in the area where the ice stays frozen year-round and is permanently in the freezing temperatures. Mount Ararat is a unique mountain because it sits off by itself, and it's very impressive, you know, being so high, you know, being almost 17,000 feet, you know. Mount Rainier is 14,410, and this is almost 17,000. They say that Mount Rainier may have the largest volume of any mountain in the world because most mountains are right smack up against other mountains, and so they share a lot of the mass. But because this mountain sits all by itself, it doesn't share any of its mass with another mountain, and it may have the largest mass and volume of any mountain in the world. And so I didn't realize how high it is and how dangerous it is for several reasons. It is a dormant volcano. It had a major earthquake in 1840. And, of course, earthquake moves things around. The upper third of the mountain is covered with snow and ice throughout the year. The ice covers 17 square miles. Up there, sometimes the ice is up to 350 feet deep, and it's in quite a few places it's over 200 feet deep, and so you can see how impossible it is if something is down under the ice to get to it. Classical writers used to consider Ararat impossible to scale, but it was finally scaled in 1829. Prior to the fall of the Soviet Union, Armenia was a part of the Russian state, and border conflicts often made it impossible for climbers to gain access to the mountain. But there's conflict, local conflicts off and on between the local Armenians and the local Kurdish tribes and then the Turkish people themselves. So there's been tribal conflicts, as well as the fact that this is kind of no man's land for people doing illegal things, you know, bandits and people dealing in drugs and all that. So it's a pretty wild area. And some people have been killed in, like, falls and avalanches and all, but other people have been killed by criminals that have gone into that area. It's high enough that it takes an average climber a full 3 days to get to the top. And that doesn't even allow time for looking around. That's just trying to go straight to the top. It takes 3 days to get up there. I thought, well, maybe the ark had completely decayed. But if God wanted the ark preserved, what a perfect place. Up so high that it's in ice permanently. And that's the only way it could have survived, in a glacier. Now, you might think, well, was it terribly cold when Noah and his family got off the ark and all? But it might not have been all that cold. One major theory is that the mountains of the earth were not as high as they are today. And that would make it easier to cover all the mountains with water. And so if the mountains were lower, then maybe toward the end of the flood, God caused the mountains to start raising up. And so maybe this ark is floating up here above Mount Ararat, and Ararat's down below it underwater, and so then Ararat raises up and kind of lifts the ark up. Who knows, that might have been how it happened. We've heard so much about global warming, and I don't think that what human beings are doing has much effect on any warming or cooling. But if this is the time when God wanted the ark to be found and photographed, then this warming in that part of the world and the meltback allows that to happen. Okay, with that introduction, I think I'm ready to show you these slides that were made by Mario Siegel. He gave these in a Bible study. Just a couple of weeks ago. And see if this remote works. Okay. So now he's just starting off with this quote. And God said to Noah, make yourself an ark of gopher wood. Make rooms in the ark and cover it inside and outside with pitch. Let me see if this, see the word pitch. One of the documents from way back, I think a couple of, like 2,000 years ago, is that people were going up there to get pitch or bitumen and tar to use for fires and things like that. There's been a lot of claims about what people have found and brought back. Going on, you shall make a window for the ark, and you shall finish it to a cubit from above, and set the door of the ark in its side. You shall make it with lower, second, and third decks. Then the ark rested in the seventh month on the mountains of Ararat. Now, toward the end of the sermon, I think we'll read a few more verses than that. But that kind of gives us a start. Now, this is a view. That's Mount Ararat on the left. But the mountain on the right is called Little Ararat. And because Little Ararat is closer to the camera, it looks like they're about the same height. But I think there's like 4,000 feet difference in the height, so it's not nearly as high, but even that has snow much of the time. And so there are 17 square miles of ice cap, and the snow is up to 300 feet deep, he says. And mountains always, it's hard to imagine how big mountains are because, you know, when you're far away, it's hard to judge when you don't have much to compare with. That's been a very dangerous, difficult mountain to climb. One thing unusual about that mountain, being in a volcano, an extinct volcano, it does still give off carbon dioxide gas. Gases come up. Well, you know, mountains tend to collect clouds and fog around them anyway. But this mountain especially tends to collect fog because whenever that carbon dioxide gas starts seeping out, that creates a fog. And so that quite often it's been difficult to climb Mount Ararat just because of the thick clouds and fog around it. Now, this is a view of Mount Ararat which shows different sections of it. And in all the things I've been reading in the last few days, I don't remember reading a description about exactly where. I don't think they really want people to know exactly where it is. One of the things they're doing is that they are the Turkish government is trying to get the United Nations to declare this official UNESCO site so that it'll be officially guarded by the United Nations, because they're so afraid that people seeking relics and people that want to go get relics to sell and that people want to go maybe to do vandalism, things like that, they're so afraid that it's going to be damaged in some way. And so that's one reason they delayed in announcing this. And now they're trying to get official protection for it. This just shows you some of the steep slopes. There's quite a few glaciers. One thing I read says there's only one bona fide glacier. There's a difference between a glacier and just thick ice cap. A glacier, I think, technically, is something that slowly moves. Most of this ice does not move. Whether we call them glaciers or not, there's a lot of ice and a lot of snow, and many parts of it are very, very steep. And this is a 1916-1917 Russian expedition drawing, according to eyewitnesses. So they certainly claim that they saw it. The ark being 300 cubits long, and if you took the short cubit of just 18 inches, that means 450 feet long. Well, the part that's been discovered hasn't nearly been that long, but almost everybody who's seen it has said it seems to be broken, and we don't know. And maybe the earthquakes and rock slides and avalanches and everything have moved part of it somewhere else. What they have found is pretty big. And if you took the Leroy Neff in his research, he really believes that the cubit was like around 24 inches. And if that was what is meant by the cubit, then it would have been 600 feet long instead of 450 feet long. Now, even 450 feet is the length is like 1.5 football fields long. And if you use the 2-foot cubit, then that means it would have been like 2 football fields long. I think I've got these printed out down here, and let me read you. It's the part didn't show up at the bottom. This is a picture of George Hagopian in the U.S. before his death. He was the Armenian who, as a boy, said he climbed up into the ark and visited it 2 times. And so he claimed to have found a lot of evidence. Oh, there it shows. I see. Have to click it again to get the part at the bottom. That's what I just read to you down at the bottom. Okay. Now I'll click it again. The ark is portrayed by George Hagopian during the summers of 1902 to 1906, prior to the great earthquake in the region that might have broken it in two. And so maybe more of it could be seen before that earthquake, a major earthquake. Ed Davis, an American engineer during World War II, gives descriptions of the Ark. And he claimed to have quite a bit of evidence. He certainly gave a lot of description of what he saw. Now, this is the drawing by Ed Davis as he saw the Ark in 1943. And one thing that makes this latest team believe that it is the Ark is that of the people who had the most evidence in the past and where they described finding it does fit right in with where this team found it. So that's a good sign. And if you'll note, here's the Ark, and this arrow is pointing down this practically a sheer cliff, this precipice. And so you can see why it's difficult to get to. If you're trying to come up from below, it's like you're going up a cliff practically. And it also, because being on the edge of a valley, it's an area that easily gets filled in with ice and snow most years. And let me digress a little bit here to say that there are some people that are trying to make excuses and say why they don't think this is valid. And some are claiming, well, I just think they planted this evidence. They hauled all this wood up there and planted it to make it look like it was Noah's Ark. Well, if you were going to do that, if you were going to bring heavy, heavy timbers up, you'd have to get up there, you'd have to assemble it. And in terribly harsh conditions. And then you would have to trust that, to make it look valid, that it's going to be covered with ice and snow. And you, if you were going to put it up there, so wouldn't you put it on kind of more of a level area rather than on the edge of a cliff? I mean, why make things that difficult to put it in one of the most difficult areas to get to? So it's just so totally illogical that somebody would have brought a bunch of stuff up there. Also, the Ark has been covered with ice and snow, but it's also been covered, listen to this, it's also been covered with a lot of volcanic rock. It shows that either Mount Ararat or some nearby volcano has thrown up all this rock, and the rock has come down on top of the Ark. So if somebody's trying to say, oh, I think this stuff was hauled up there by somebody to make it look like an Ark, they not only would have to trust that that it would get filled in and covered over with ice and snow, but that they would have to have had a monumental effort to haul all this rock to put on top of it. That is so far-fetched. And the Turkish government says, look, that's so totally ridiculous. We observe this mountain all the time. I mean, this is a very touchy area militarily and politically. We monitor this mountain all the time. We can assure you that there's been no major activity, because to conceive of planting evidence means you would have to have helicopters, you know, huge helicopters and all kinds of things, because the truck road only goes up to like, I think about half the distance. And then you got a jeep trail that goes up a little bit higher. But even with the mountain jeeps, you can't even get anywhere near this area. And the closer you get, the more rugged it goes, and much of the incline where they climb is like about a 60-degree angle. It's very, very steep. And we're talking about huge timbers, and it's just no conceivable way that this could have been planted. Now, if you don't want to believe this, The other theory is that, well, somebody was just a long time ago, somebody must have built it for a cabin or something, or maybe a stockade for their livestock or whatever. But we're talking about an area that is always frozen. The highest that trees have ever been spotted are far below this elevation. So there's no trees that have grown anywhere near this elevation. And nobody in his right mind is going to go try to build a cabin on a glacier, or, you know, on ice or something like that. So it makes no sense that, there has never been any kind of structure ever discovered up anywhere near this height. In other words, they have not found any kind of goat corral or cabin or any wood structure anywhere near this high an elevation. Okay, a Dutch television crew filming a documentary with astronaut James Irwin inadvertently took a picture of what appears to be part of the Ark in 1986. Colonel Irwin died of a heart attack before he could mount a ground expedition to confirm the find. So, there again, it wasn't God's timing. You know, he was going to go up to there to that spot, but he died. And that was just back in 1986, but that was an aerial photo. Now, this is one of the Hong Kong explorers. This man's name is Panda Lee. Panda Lee. And when I send you this link, you can go hear him. He speaks not only Chinese but English, and so what you can read or listen to is him speaking in Chinese, but you can also listen to him speaking in English, explaining some things. But he's in there getting a close-up view of the lower section of what appears to be beams sticking out. I hope you can see that pretty well. Now, this is the lower photo is in some kind of a museum where there's an ancient ship that was put together by mortise and tenon. And most of what is explained here is explaining what a mortise and tenon is, because that's how this what they found up there on Mount Ararat is put together. You know, they had no metal nails. There are pegs. But most of the pieces, the major pieces, are fit together by mortise and tenon. And the blue object shows the end of it is cut down to a smaller piece sticking out. Well, that's called the tenon. And then the hole and the piece on the left, the yellow piece, the hole is the mortise. And you cut them so they fit together perfectly. And it's like fitting a peg into a hole. And that's how for thousands of years woodworkers have joined pieces of wood, usually when the pieces are at an angle close to 90 degrees. The end of the first member is called the tenon, and it usually is narrowed with respect to the rest of the piece. The hole in the second member is called the mortise. The joint may be glued, pinned, or wedged to lock it in place. And the picture at the lower right is just an example of an ancient ship that was put together by mortise and tenon. And that's what they found up there in this latest find, as to how this big boat is put together. Now this is, see if there's any reading with this. Okay, April 25th, news conference in Hong Kong, NoahsArkSearch.net. That is their website. This shows the seven compartments they entered. To gauge the size, the tiny orange figure is a man. I think from where you're sitting, you can't even see the orange figures. But in each one of those, compartments, they've got a tiny figure to show how huge these compartments are. And they just can't get in between those compartments because these are the parts where there was enough melting or maybe protected enough that they weren't filled with ice and snow. But see, most of the compartments are just totally filled with ice so that they can't get in them. But they actually got into seven different compartments. See, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Now, this man standing down here is about as tall as the height of two of my fingers. That's how tall, by comparison, the man is there. And so these are huge compartments. One of them was found when a photographer just fell through the hole, nearly hurt himself bad. And so they had to get into some of these compartments, they had to belay. You know what belaying is? You hook a rope around you and you lower somebody down. And so they actually had to go down with ropes to get down into these huge compartments. Doesn't seem like anything somebody would have hauled up there. These are examples of some of the pieces they brought back. It says evidence found inside the ark. Wood tested by carbon-14 dating method was found to be 4,800 years old, which is great. That's close, because according to the Bible chronology, it would have been like 4,400. And we know that carbon-14 dating, the farther you go back, the less accurate it is. But that's pretty close for carbon-14 dating to indicate that it's really close to what we would say would be the date of the flood. Now, white pellets are either food for animals like Milo or seeds to replant the earth. And the rope is used to secure things on a ship and to tie animals down. So this is wood. That is, I think, petrified wood. This is these white little pellets. This is right there is some rope. And I think this is a piece of that petrified wood, and this is a piece of wood, maybe petrified, I'm not sure. But those are just some of the samples they have brought back. Okay, deductions if Noah's Ark is found. A ship some 450 feet long at 14,000 feet could not have been brought up there. It must have rested there from floating above. It means that the waters must have been above this level and therefore must have covered the entire earth. Not only that, they have found lots of fossils up there at the top of Mount Ararat. Oceanic fossils up there. So that's further evidence that it was below water at a time. Now, Mario gives some good conclusions, some good points of significance about this. Seven ways Noah's Ark would be a witness. Number one, it would be a witness to a mostly unbelieving world. A powerful witness. Two, it would be a witness that God exists, for only a supreme being could have given the warning ahead of time. Three, it would be a witness that prophecy is true, for nobody would have built a ship like this to survive a universal flood unless he was told ahead of time. It also shows prophecy still is true for the future, for the same God gave it. So many truths. It's just like many, many pieces of the puzzle fit together. Number four, it would be a witness to the Bible being true, for it is the only source that accurately describes such a ship and the moral reason for it to have been built. Number five, it would be a witness to science and show how far off man's ideas are about evolution, geology, and stratigraphy. Stratigraphy has to do with knowing about stratus of the earth. Number six, it would be a witness to the immorality of the world, for it would show God once before had to intervene because of mankind had disregarded his laws. Number seven, it would be a witness to the church, for God would have given us the greatest marketing tool since the empty tomb almost 2,000 years ago. Are we up to the task, or will God have to use some other Church of God group? We have the means, we have the most manpower, but will we be ready to take this message in a powerful way to the world? One other thing I think of is that it is also the story of the flood is a great testimony to God's grace and mercy, in that he did provide a way of saving Noah and his family. And so it's kind of like when God calls us, the church becomes our ark. We are safe as long as we are in the church. The church is our ark to carry us through the tribulation and the terrible things that are happening in the future. And, of course, we know about the second resurrection. We know God is so merciful that even these people that died for all kinds of reasons are going to have their opportunity for salvation. That's about the most awesome truth to me. And that's just a Jesus Christ prophesied. But as the days of Noah were, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark, and did not know until the flood came and took them all away. So also will be the coming of the Son of Man. Therefore you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. Will we heed the warning? So that is a powerful warning and something to think about. Jesus said that it will be very similar, that even though people saw the great faith and dedication of Noah and his family building a ship on dry ground, and with all the preaching and all the building, they just would not believe it. And they just carried on with their everyday lives, eat, drink, and be merry. And Jesus said that's going to be the way it is, that for most people, no matter how much evidence there is and how much preaching there is, most people are just going to ignore it and turn a blind eye and think everything's going to be all right. And he also used the example of Lot. He said just like in the city of Sodom, they just carried on eating and drinking and ignoring the warnings until fire came. And I think that is that's the last slide. Okay, it works. Hey, my first PowerPoint presentation. What do you think? Here are some of the dangers of trying to climb Mount Ararat. Avalanches, snow avalanches and rock slides are just extremely common. Bandits and criminals. Has been dangerous. It's been a very lawless area. I mentioned the carbon dioxide creating an unusual amount of fog frequently around the mountain. Great crevasses. Of course, glaciers are noted for that. Falling in giant crevasses and getting killed or injured. Earthquakes. It has been prone to earthquakes and falling rocks. Also, Mount Ararat has an unusual amount of lightning, and some people have been killed by lightning because it is such a pointed mountain and it is all by itself, and so it's like a giant lightning rod, and so they have terrible lightning storms there. Politics and the political history have kept climbers from going up. One of the most interesting stories is that in 1916, a Russian flying an airplane thought he saw the Ark, and so he went back and reported that and got permission from the Russian government to send a big team of explorers. And so they sent soldiers and archaeologists and geologists and mountain climbers a big contingent down there, and they climbed, and they claimed they found it and took photographs. Well, they get back to Moscow, and guess what happens right after that? The Bolshevik Revolution. And so the Tsar Nicholas and his family are all killed, slaughtered. Huge numbers of people are slaughtered. Most of these people who climbed Mount Ararat were killed. All the photographs disappeared. You know, it's amazing how things are choreographed and the timing of things and how that, you know, things seem to happen for more than one reason. So time and time again, I have an article here. You probably read it, but you probably forgot about it. But in February 2000, in the World News and Prophecy publication, is this article by Mario Segli called Update on the Search for Noah's Ark. And so he summarized what had been discovered up until that time. And he starts off by calling Noah's Ark the Phantom Ship, and how it's just so weird how many people have tried to find it and thought they saw it and thought they touched it and all that, but the evidence has disappeared and people dying and all kinds of strange things happen to keep there from being substantial evidence of it. And so it is amazing. Just the story of the strange things that have happened is fascinating. Religious differences, weather, wild animals. There are some dangerous animals in that area. So I've talked about the claims that this is not really the Noah's Ark. One of the people who is trying to discredit this is an American archaeologist. And to me, this is just a clear case of sour grapes because he was invited to go with this expedition. But he decided it was too dangerous, and he was skeptical of finding it anyway, so he backed out. So when they made this discovery, made this announcement, well, rather than to make himself feel better that, man, I really missed out, I should have been along, I should not have backed out on this, he's one of the main voices claiming, oh, this just can't be true. I just think there's another explanation for it and all that. And so part of when you go to this website by the Hong Kong group, they're partly countering what his claims are. And they're saying, well, it's really a shame that he's saying these things publicly and getting all this attention because for this reason and this reason, they give a lot of reasons why they don't think that his ideas could possibly be true. For example, he thinks, well, I think the stuff was hauled up from the Black Sea area and just people hauled it up there just to make it look like it was an ark. So it is truly fascinating. If you want to do more research, you'll certainly get to learn a lot when you go to those websites. Now, I'm also going to send you the Arnold Mendez's website. So regardless of whether you have seen his seminars or will see his seminar in the future, that you can learn a lot about the Ark and the physical description and how it's all very logical from his websites. And it's interesting that over in Ezekiel 14, there's two verses that mention Noah, Daniel, and Job as being righteous men, and said that even though Noah, Daniel, and Job would be with you, they could not save you. The point being that you can only be saved by your own righteousness, not by somebody else's righteousness. I forgot to bring my Bible. Excuse me. Since we don't have videos of our services, for anyone listening to this in the future on audio recording, I hope that I explained enough about those slides so that people are not going to be too confused by not having the video part of it. But let's turn to Luke 16. I'll read a few scriptures. Let's turn and read a few scriptures back in Genesis 6 and one in Genesis 8. Let's just review these scriptures, just the part about the description of the ark. Genesis 6, beginning in verse 11. The earth also was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. So God looked upon the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. And God said to Noah, "The end of all flesh is come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will destroy them with the earth. Make yourself an ark of gopher wood, make rooms in the ark, and cover it inside and outside with pitch. And this is how you shall make it. The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits, its width 50 cubits, and its height 30 cubits. You shall make a window for the ark, and you shall finish it to the cubit from above, and set the door of the ark in its side. You shall make it with lower, second, and third decks." And then turn over to chapter 8, and verse 4 says, "Then the ark rested in the 17th month, the 17th day of the month, on the mountains of Ararat." So apparently at that time, more than one mountain was called Ararat. I mean, I guess that general area was called Ararat. But since that time, mountains may have gone upward and moved downward both. Let's go down to Luke 16. Luke 16 shows how that if people don't want to believe, you can't make them believe something. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. If somebody is determined not to believe, then they can still disbelieve no matter what. Because here is the story of Lazarus and the rich man. And I'm going to break into the story at verse 27. So this is the rich man speaking. He says, He said, "I beg you therefore, Father, that you would send him to my father's house," you know, to warn my father, "for I have five brothers, that he may testify to them, lest they also come to this place of torment." Abraham said to him, "They have Moses and the prophets. Let them hear them." And he said, "No, Father Abraham, but if one goes to them from the dead, they will repent." But he said to him, "If they do not hear Moses and the prophets, neither will they be persuaded, though one rise from the dead." In other words, if people are closed-minded toward the scriptures, that they oftentimes are so closed-minded that you could perform the greatest miracle in the world, and they still would not believe. But we still got to do our part, because we've got to warn them, and some will believe. Now we go to the next chapter, Luke 17, and verse 26. And this is similar to what we read in Matthew. It says, "As it was in the days of Noah, so it will also be in the days of the Son of Man. They ate, they drank, they married wives, they were given in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark and the flood came and destroyed them all." Now I'd like you to look at 2 Peter 3. 2 Peter 3. Let's begin in verse 3. "Knowing this first, that scoffers will come in the last days, walking according to their own lust." Well, we've got lots of skeptics and a lot of scoffers that just poo-poo the idea. In fact, they just think, "Oh, you're a bunch of kooks, you know, to believe that there was a great flood that covered the whole earth, and that there was a great ark to save people, and that the ark might still exist and all that." And, you know, the people that are really interested in this, they call them archaeologists. Instead of spelling it A-R-C-H, they spell it A-R-K, archaeologist. And why do people want to be so skeptical? It says right here, because they're walking according to their own lust. You know, it's like, I don't want to believe in a God, because then I might have to change my ways. I might have to quit being so immoral. Verse 4, "and saying, where is the promise of his coming?" Ha ha, people have always claimed he's coming back. It's not going to happen. For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of creation. Verse 4 is a good summary of what is meant by uniformitarianism. That means everything that has ever happened has been by a gradual, natural process. Nothing supernatural, nothing sudden, nothing dramatic, just the gradual changes. And that's what they want to believe. Verse 5, for this they willfully forget. They not only forget, but why do they forget? Because they want to forget. For this they willfully forget that by the word of God the heavens were of old and the earth standing out of water and in the water by which the world that then existed perished, being flooded with water. It's saying they willfully forget that there ever was a worldwide flood. Verse 7, but the heavens and the earth, which are now preserved by the same word, are reserved for fire until the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men. But, beloved, do not forget this one thing, that with the Lord one day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is one day. The Lord is not slack concerning his promise, as some count slackness, but is long-suffering toward us. Why? Here's the reason. Not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. God gives more time than what people expect to allow more people to come to repentance. Verse 10, but the day of the Lord will come. And when it comes, it's going to come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with great noise. The elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up. And verse 11 is a good message for us. Therefore, since all these things will be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness? Now, there's going to be, you might say, a partial fire on the earth with the tribulation and then the day of the Lord and all that. And then later on, after the millennium and after the great white throne judgment period, then there's going to be a total fire that is going to burn the whole surface of the earth, because then everybody will have had his chance for salvation by that time. So this chapter covers a lot of time. But that is really full of lessons and meaning in this chapter. Now I want to turn to one more scripture, because regardless of how skeptical people are and unbelieving and closed-minded and all that, almost the entire 10th chapter of Matthew, I'm not going to read near the entire chapter, but nearly the entire chapter of Matthew 10 is about the preaching of the gospel and how important it is. Now, it applied to the disciples that he was sending out, but it certainly applies to our days too, and that's why it's in the Bible. In verse 5 of Matthew 10, these 12 Jesus sent out and commanded them, saying, do not go into the way of the Gentiles and do not enter a city of the Samaritans, but rather go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And as you go, preach, saying, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Heal the sick, cleanse the lepers, raise the dead, cast out demons. Freely you have received and freely give. And, of course, the whole chapter is interesting and inspiring. But let's skip down to verse 22. Verse 22, and you will be hated by all for my name's sake, but he who endures to the end will be saved. When they persecute you in this city, flee to another. For surely I say to you, you will not have gone through the cities of Israel before the Son of Man comes. And now let's go down to verse 26 and 27. Therefore do not fear them, for there is nothing covered that will not be revealed and hidden that will not be known. Now I'm seeing a new meaning to this scripture. The part about being covered primarily means covering truth, you know, hiding truth. And so that the mystery of God and the plan of God and everything is going to be made known and all of that. However, I see a neat little second application of this scripture now about the ark has been covered, but it is being revealed. Now, verse 27. Whatever I tell you in the dark, speak in the light, and what you hear in the ear, preach on the housetops. Shout it as loud and as long as you can. Try to get an audience. Try to reach people and make it known. Lift up your voice and cry aloud and shout it from the housetops. And I dearly, dearly, dearly hope we can do that, that we can do a job that God is going to be well pleased with, to take the wonderful knowledge we have of the Bible plus the knowledge that God gives us of what's going on in the world and the fulfillment of prophecy and the understanding of the significance of finding what apparently is Noah's Ark and make the very best of it and do a wonderful, tremendous job of preparing the way for the return of Jesus Christ.